I don't know that there was a moment, but I remember the realization coming that as we went into these doctor's offices and we checked off treatment after treatment, I understood that we were getting to the end of the list and that they, I don't know if someone said it, but there was a very clear understanding that, for me at least, that they didn't think I was going to be able to walk probably ever.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. And the whole idea behind setting up this podcast is to sit down with people who are on the path of mastery to better understand what they're searching for, like to really dig and get underneath the surface, what they're craving for, what they're hungry for, what they're driven by, what they're driven toward. We want to understand their psychological framework, which is how they make sense of the world and themselves and events in it. And we also want to dig to understand the mental skills that they've used to build and refine their craft. And that's a lot. That is a lot to try to understand. But what else are we doing? That's what we're trying to do, is understand and learn from the best. What are some of the best practices that people use that are extraordinary thinkers and doers? How have they done what they've done? Okay, brilliant. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus, their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery. Or use the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer: hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. All right, this week's conversation is with former USA Volleyball national team member Cassidy Lichtman. And just for perspective, to make a national team roster is extraordinary. And so she's one of those folks that have been on the national team for a healthy amount of time. But what makes it more engaging is that at the age of 9, Cassidy developed a chronic pain disorder in one of her legs, and she was told that she might never walk again. Just imagine that for a minute. Imagine waking up one day with pain, pain you didn't understand, pain that apparently all the medical professionals had no cure for. No matter how many doctors they visited and really looked for answers, there was more question marks than any type of guidance, really. Part of that equation is dealing with the physical pain. And not to be insensitive anyway, but over a short period of time, most of us can manage physical pain. But it's that chronic pain that gets really tricky. And more importantly, it's the emotional pieces that hang with that or are coupled with chronic pain that becomes really challenging. And I lived it myself. I had a little bit. It compares nothing to what this conversation is about. If you have chronic pain, if you know somebody that has dealt with pain, you'll really want to dial into this conversation because what she's done is extraordinary. Cassidy is flat out a fighter. She has persevered her entire life. And despite unsuccessful efforts to treat the pain, she's relearned how to walk. I mean, that was part of her journey to relearn how to walk. And from that point, she began playing volleyball and getting re-engaged in sports all the way through all the hoops and challenges you can imagine to become one of the team members on the USA national team. Is that rad or what? I mean, to be able to do that is unbelievable. And in this conversation, Cassidy shares her experiences of overcoming pain, making the best of the opportunities given to her, and choosing to live her life doing what she loves, not letting her life being dictated by her pain. And in other words, not, and there's a fine line here, I'm going to suggest, that there's a relationship between pain and suffering, and the two are different. And so she is not suffering, but she has pain. There's so much to learn from Cassidy. She has an incredible spirit, and that will jump out in the early part of this conversation that is obviously threaded throughout. But she's developed and earned a perspective of what matters most, and she's competed at the highest level of her sport. So this is a rare conversation because she's one of the few people that I work with from a team setting, from a team perspective, but didn't do individual work. So this was more of an educational relationship that she and I had from the USA National Volleyball Program. So this is a unique perspective, and I think you'll enjoy it, the nuances of it. And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Cassidy. Cassidy, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. This is going to, I think, be a very unique, a very different conversation. And usually I have a sense of where conversations might go, but with you, I don't know.
I never go into conversation with you assuming a destination.
Okay, good. So a little backstory. We've known each other a long time. You were a member of the women's national team indoor volleyball for America, for the United States. And we had the pleasure of knowing each other for a handful of years while you were competing on the world stage. Mm-hmm. So that has led me to understand something that's really unique about you. One of the best in the world at what you do, indoor women's volleyball, to make the national team in the United States is a significant marker of command of craft. And I just want to ask you one question before I take that thought any further. What is your relationship with pain?
I would say we have a very close relationship. I don't love it. But I think I've come to a place in my life where I can accept its presence.
Okay. That's a big deal because you've lived with it for a long time, chronic pain.
Yeah.
In a way that some of the brightest minds in medicine haven't figured out what's going on for you. And so can you walk us through early years and like what that was like growing up, just to set the context for this, what I think is an extraordinary commitment to be able to pursue whatever it is that you're pursuing, and in your case, volleyball, in context with incredible pain? So just shape the early years.
Yeah. So early years pre-pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was a really active kid. I think sports were always a part of our lives. I grew up with an older brother, which I think shaped a lot of my childhood because, you know, that older sibling often, you know, he gets into a certain activity and then I'm going to do it too. So if he's playing Little League baseball, it's like, I'm going to play Little League baseball with the boys. And he's going to be on the swim team, I'm going to be on the swim team, whatever it was. So I think I was this kind of very interesting mix of like very kind of quiet and shy, but also very fearless in a lot of ways. You know, I would climb anything that was really high and I would go into little caves and play tackle football out in the front yard with all the kids in the neighborhood. And I was the youngest and the only girl. Like, that's the kid I was, but I was also really quiet. Didn't talk much. I feel like I was kind of observing and learning from the world around me for much of my childhood. So I listened a lot. I watched people and I read a lot of books. So I think most of my childhood, I would say, was spent either somewhere reading a book or somewhere playing a game. We were outside a lot, playing anything at the pool, at the park, in our front yard.
What part of the world did you grow up in?
I was born in San Diego, and then I moved to Houston, and we lived there for 7 years before moving back to San Diego after that.
Okay. And then how did mom and dad spend their time?
My dad at the time was in the oil business. He had been a geologist and then kind of segued into that, which I don't think was like his passion, but he did that. That's why we moved to Texas. And then we moved back and he's been involved in education ever since. And my mom is a volleyball coach, and she was when I was really little. Those are my first memories of just being in a gym at her practices when my dad had to work. And so my brother and I would tag along to practice, and we would each, you know, eat dinner and then we'd get a ball. And so it wasn't like we brought games with us or toys or movies to watch. It was finish eating, go play some volleyball. And this is when I was, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old.
Okay. So like classic gym rat, you know, sport, stick and ball sport atmosphere.
Yeah.
Okay. And then was it like that? Okay. So there's lots of different ways that the texture of what that can be. It can be like, you're going to go play volleyball, or it's like, hey, get out of my hair. But the only thing that's around are volleyballs mm-hmm. because mom was or other balls. And then, or it can be like, hey guys, I love it. What can I go do after dinner? And your parents are like, well, do anything you want. And you chose a volleyball. You know what, and I'm sure there's more options, but what was the texture of your relationship with volleyball at that young age?
I loved it. I mean, I was excited to go to the gym with my mom. I think the hardest thing for her was keeping us off the court because I just wanted to go play with the, you know, 12 and 14 and 16 year olds when I was 6. So she always tells the story there. She told me that I could only come on the court if I could pass the ball to myself 100 times in a row. Which, you know, I know older kids who struggle with that a lot who currently play. And so she told me that thinking it would keep me occupied for at least an hour or a few days or the good. Next time. And I, so good. I went off and did it. And so I came back and said, okay, mom, I did it. Now I got to go on the court. Like, that was the deal.
So like bump passing?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, and okay. Well, that's an interesting model, right? Because it's like, no. It's not, no, don't get on the court. You're not good enough. You're not old enough. Maybe there was some of that in there, but there was this metric of like, if I'm skilled enough, then I get to go play.
Right.
And your mom said, listen, anyone out here pretty much needs to be able to be at this minimum threshold. And I'm sure it was like, hey, go away, kid.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm trying to work here.
Yeah.
But not disrespectful to our sons and daughters in that mm-hmm. way, but you know, but like, so that's an interesting model to grow up with. If I'm good enough, then I've earned the right to go compete.
Exactly. And to give a reachable goal. I don't know that she thought it was reachable at the time, but I think I was somewhat unusual in that most kids aren't going to go away and focus on a task like that for a long enough time. So I think what she thought would have happened was I go try it, I can't do it, I get bored and stop. And what actually happened was I go off and I just pass the ball to myself hundreds of times and then come back and say, okay, I'm ready to go. Which I think ended up being who I was as a player, right? But it definitely started at that age of, you know, I have this thing, I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna do it well.
Look at that model still at play for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So then zoom forward to some of the thoughts that your parents installed at a young age for you. And I'm just trying to get framework stuff, you know, mm-hmm. context, like, okay, growing up in San Diego, warm climate, Houston, you know, pretty warm climate, outside a lot, inside in volleyball gyms, your parents were more about performance-based rather than limits otherwise. And what other thoughts did they install for you at a young age? And that's a weird word, right? Install, but that's just to be almost aggressive in that term.
I mean, a lot of what I remember is from when I was a little bit older, which I'm sure they started out when we were younger. I mean, a huge part of our childhood was just, you know, how you treat other people, you know, following the golden rule and all of that. And then what I remember a lot growing up was just them encouraging us to do our best. Like, this is jumping forward a little bit, but, you know, I remember my brother and I were both pretty good students. And so I remember getting into sort of middle school, and he's older than me, so he gets to, you know, the harder grades earlier, and he got his first B. It was the first time either of us had gotten anything other than an A in school. And I remember thinking, like, okay, what happens now? Like, going home and being ready for whatever my parents were going to say and not knowing what the consequences for that are.
Did you think that there was going to be a consequence, or
I just didn't know. I wasn't like worried about it. It was just, okay, what's going to happen now? And I think my dad may have actually said it. He was like, hey, you worked really hard in this class, to my brother. You worked really hard in this class. And, you know, if you do your best, like, that's what we want. And you do your best and you get a B, awesome. Congratulations, well done. And I was like, oh, okay. And then, second story that relates, I remember getting I was probably a little bit older, maybe my freshman year. My mom picks me up from school and I said, hey, I got my history test back today. And she's like, okay, great. How'd it go? How'd you do? I said, oh, mom, I got 103 on it. She's like, wow, you got all the problems right? And I said, well, no, I missed a couple, but there was 5 points extra credit. So I got 103. And she was like, well, why'd you miss those? And I was like, hang on. I just told you got over 100 on a test and you're asking me why I did. And she goes, no, I was just wondering, you know, what happened. And I was, you know, a little bit exasperated at the time, like, mom, give me a break here. But it was genuinely a process question. It was like, could you have done better, or did you do the best you could and you got 103? So the lesson in my mind kind of always growing up was like, hey, if you do the best you can and you get a B, awesome. But don't get 103 when you can get 105, right?
Yeah. Okay. And how did mom, because that can create like a lot of stress for people, like, as an example, you got 103, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And that's certainly critical, right? Like, you 105 is in your capability. Why did you get 105? And it doesn't sound like that was the tone. So was there a way that she asked those questions, or
I think,
cause it's more than just that one story,
yeah,
right? But is there a way that she would pull that out of you? Was it soft? Was it aggressive? Was it intense?
They were never, like, I mean, I was pretty self-motivated. So I never really got that from my parents of like, why aren't you doing better?
What does self-motivated mean?
I think they instilled these lessons in me in some other ways earlier on. And so that when I went to school or whatever I did, I wanted to do my best. And I knew if I wasn't, like, you know, if you're going in and you're not giving everything you have on something, or if you got the test back and you're like, oh, I could have done more. So I think that was a personal kind of competitiveness or whatever it was in me to go, oh, I didn't want to get that one wrong. I could have done it better. So when she was asking those questions, it genuinely was like, you know, should you have studied more and that's why you didn't get it, or you just didn't know the answer? And, you know, as we're having this conversation, I go, no, I just didn't know the answer. So it's not like they're asking me things that I'm not thinking of myself, right? Like, I always wanted to get everything right, but not to the point where I was anxious about it. Just like, I want to do it right if I can do it right.
Okay. And you really feel like it was self-driven as opposed to the ecosystem helped to cultivate that from you?
Well, they definitely, I mean, my parents helped cultivate that and that they taught me to be that way, I think.
Okay.
But it wasn't a driving force from the outside going, you shouldn't get questions wrong, or you need to get better grades, or you need to work harder, or anything like that. It was just, I expect to do well. And so I have to put in the work to do that.
What do you think of the word perfection?
I don't think that we can reach it, but I think we should always strive to. And So I think to me, yeah, it's like, yeah, that's the goal, but it's not what I'm going to measure myself against. I'm going to measure myself against what I can do.
I had a conversation recently, and he's been on the podcast, Alex Honnold, who is one of the great free soloist climbers, the greatest possibly in the world, just climbed 3,000 foot El Capitan without a rope. And I asked him about how he organizes his principles in his life. And he said, they're very clear and loosely held. And I thought that was really fascinating because his thought was that I'm really clear about how I want to behave, and I'm very intentional about my thoughts and my words and what I do. And for example, he's a vegetarian, and he says, but when I'm in different places of the world and there's no food and someone's cooking up a big, you know, roast, I'm going to eat it.
Yeah.
You know, so, and he's a conscious eater, like he doesn't, but so it's not this rigid drive for perfection. And then I hear you say perfection is the pursuit, but I'm not holding myself to that standard. I'm holding myself to something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. Then drop us right into where pain happened and that intersection in your life. Everything's going great.
Yeah. That's a good phrase. Like, drop us right into it. Cause I kind of just got dropped right into it. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. Yeah. There's no clear explanation. I was 9 years old. We're living in San Diego. I was a healthy standard child. And then I went to bed one night, like a week and a half before Christmas when I was 9, and I woke up the next morning and there was just this shooting pain going down my left shin area. And I tried to stand up and that made it hurt worse. And so I think I hobbled around a little bit, and then we got a pair of crutches for me. And it honestly wasn't that big a deal. We went to the doctors. I mean, kids get hurt, and I was, again, super active, like borderline reckless in some ways physically. So everyone just figured that I had fallen or hurt it in some way. So I went to the doctors and we did some x-rays and nothing showed up, but they thought it was probably a hairline fracture or something. And those often don't show up in the x-rays. So then we did an MRI. And so this is over the course of a week or two or three. And we did a blood test and more x-rays. And so as we're going through these, it started to get a little bit more odd. And again, I'm 9 years old. I'm in these rooms with doctors. I don't talk to many people, so I'm definitely not talking to them. But I assume that they're going to give me an answer, because that's how the world works, right? Like, you get sick or you get hurt and then you go to the doctor and they fix you. And that was how I understood the world at that time.
So was it fear-based or hope-based or a little bit of both?
It was pretty neutral. I was like, okay, I'm just going to go and then they're going to make it better. You know, in the same way that I get an ear infection, they give me medicine. Or, you know, I fell and cut myself and they gave me stitches. Like, there will be some, it's unfortunate that this hurts, but there will be a fix and then we'll be fine. And then as we went through those appointments, I'm watching the doctors and their faces and the tone of voice and all of that. And it goes from, yeah, this is totally fine, this is normal, to they're a little bit confused. They don't have the answers. And now we're not really sure what we're doing. So I think as that progressed, I got a little uneasy. And then we just kept going to more doctors. I mean, that was so, more tests and more tests. And
how many doctors over the course of your life, how many specialists have you been to?
I have no idea. A lot. I mean, in the course of that 1 year alone, it had to have been somewhere between 30 and 50. I don't even know. I remember going up. I counted one day. So at the end, so we're going through this whole process of tests and nothing's working. And so we ended up going up to Stanford. I was just fortunate because my uncle was the head of pediatrics there, which is, that's a good person to know if you have mysterious conditions. And so we went up there to see some doctors, and I remember counting, and we saw 10 in one day. And I was just sitting in the waiting room for the last one, wondering if there are people who go their whole lives seeing less doctors than that, you know? And we got to, so this is months, like probably 2 months later, at least. So I've been on crutches this whole time, in pain that whole time. And we get...
Scale of one to ten, like the level of pain, is this a five? Is this a eight? Like, where are you on that scale?
I put it usually like at a four.
Okay.
Four to five. So...
And is that, that's relative to your tolerance of pain. Is that, do you think that that's the same for other people's? Other people's?
Probably.
That's not East Coast. Not. Probably not. Okay. You would say...
I would say I probably have a fairly high tolerance.
Okay.
Given,
right, good. Just
given
as calibrate.
My life. So yeah, so we'll put it at a four. So I got into the very last appointment that day, and we went and there were three doctors there, and they finally were like, okay, we think we know what's wrong. You have this kind of rare nerve disorder called, at the time it was called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Now it's called complex regional pain syndrome, or CRPS. So that was, they're like, that's what you have. And I was like, wow, you know, we have a diagnosis. And then the next thing they said was, and there's no cure. I was like, well, that makes things more difficult. So I think everything for me just kind of stopped for a second. I was like, there's no, what do you mean? There's no cure for this. But then they kept talking. They're like, oh, there's these treatments you can try. And so I went very quickly from, you know, getting hit in the stomach to, oh, well, again, there are doctors and they have answers. So I was still in that mode of, they're going to fix it. So they laid out this whole...
And again, you were nine at this?
Yes.
Okay. And so this is a really important, I think, segment of your story, because that, what you just captured, that nine-year-old with hope and a little bit of fear and the range of emotions, but, oh, well, there's a plan.
Yeah.
And coming back to like an action and a hope. Like, I think that that's an experience that all of us, not all, that's too big. So many of us experience on a regular basis. Like, oh, I just got bad information. Oh my God, I feel a certain way. And this is roller coaster. And it touches that young person, if so to speak, inside mm-hmm. of us, that younger experience. But you were in it at that time. But I think for folks listening, they're like, yeah, I know that thing, that heart-wrenching piece of information, that maybe it's a loved one hasn't been faithful, or, you know, something happened in the stock market that, you know, you've lost a lot of money, or mm-hmm. fill in the blanks.
Yeah. And then the moment where you're looking around the room, like, I mean, for me in that moment, it was somebody else out here has to have the answer. And so I'm looking around the room, like, here are adults and they're doctors. These are authority figures. They're telling me there are these options. So we're good.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out. Okay, so keep going.
Okay, so we start tons of different treatments. I mean, everything. I was on medications. I was in physical therapy to keep my leg from atrophying because I hadn't put my foot on the ground in months. And then everything down to like electrical stimulation, hypnosis, acupuncture, like ran the gamut, Eastern and Western medicine, whatever we could find. I was trying it. And so it was this kind of constant loop of try the treatment for a while. It doesn't work. Stop that one. Try the next treatment for a while. It doesn't work. Stop. Do the next one. And that was the next few months. And so I think, I don't know that there was a moment, but I remember the realization coming that as we went into these doctor's offices and we checked off treatment after treatment, I understood that we were getting to the end of the list and that they, I don't know if someone said it, but there was a very clear understanding that for me at least, that they didn't think I was going to be able to walk probably ever. Mm. And it feels like I should have had more emotion around that, but I think it was just like, I don't know how to comprehend this information because how do you, you know, how did I go from being this, you know, incredibly active child to 5 months later, these experts thinking that this is it.
Are you sad for you at that time? Like as an adult now, when you're reliving it, are you sad? Is it compassion? Are you still reliving it in any ways? Like, what is your experience now as an adult? Is it more surgical? Like, this is just the story. I'm going to say it, and there's a procedure to my story.
I think in some ways I'm sad for me, not because I think I was incredibly sad then. I just think it's sad that happens at all. I mean, I think it's sad when I meet kids now who are dealing with those kinds of things. And I'm also kind of sad for that child that I was, that wasn't the end of it, you know, that it was going to go on. So almost as if I was looking back and it wasn't me. It's like a different version of me. But yeah, I don't think it's like a surgical thing. I'm trying not to tell it in a surgical way. I think many times when I do, like if somebody just asks me about my story, I often just tell it and it's essentially, here's my medical history, right? Like this was what happened. These are tests that we ran and this is what we did. And I don't connect emotionally to it, but yeah. And when you talk about that actual moment when it's like, these people don't believe that I'm going to be able-bodied ever again. I mean, that's...
Okay. Jeez. Yeah. Okay. And then what happens next?
Then we essentially run out of treatments. And so I was in physical therapy still, but we didn't have a lot more to try. And I'm living in this moment where people think I'm not going to be able to walk and all of that. And I decide that I'm going to do it anyway. So what happened was, this is now June. So this started in December. It's been about six months. And I'm about to get out of school. I mean, it's the last week of fourth grade. And I decided that on the last day of fourth grade, I was going to walk. But I didn't decide that in April or May and let my physical therapist know and progress up to it or anything like that. I decided the week before. And I think I just said it, like, kind of honestly, kind of on a whim. And then that was it. It was going to happen. So I was excited about it until the night before. And I went to bed that night. And then I think maybe a half hour later or something, I got up, went out, hopped out to the living room or whatever, where my parents were. And they looked at me and were kind of like, what's going on? And I just lost it, like, just sobbing. And I can probably count on one hand and have fingers left over the number of times that I cried in that 6 month period when I was on crutches. Like, through all the doctor's visits and the tests and the blood draws and needles and everything. Like, I was not, like I said, I was always kind of a stoic kid. I wasn't super emotional. So I think when I just started losing it in the middle of the living room, my parents were like, whoa, what's happening? So I remember sitting on the couch between them and them going, you know, it's okay. You don't have to do this. You know, everything, it's all going to be fine. Like, just trying to calm me down. And I think in my head, it was I was just really scared. You know, I was scared because it was going to hurt. You know, there's a reason I wasn't walking. And I was scared because what if everyone was right? You know, like, up until now, I can say that someday I'm going to walk. And you can't prove that wrong. But what happens if they try? If I try and then I can't do it, then all of a sudden these people are right.
That's a massive insight, because that's one of the reasons that people pull back from trying hard.
Yep.
It's a self-esteem saving mechanism. And what we end up doing is faking it a little bit, trying less, so we can reserve inside of our own head that we didn't put it all on the line. That's why, like, college kids might show up to the midterms or finals and hungover. Mm-hmm. Well, if I would have been fresh and studied, I could have done well in this test.
Yeah.
And so that was the mechanism, right? To save some self-esteem as opposed to laying it all out there. Mm-hmm. And I think that this part of what I'm hearing right now, this part of your story, is something that so many adults and aspiring adults, meaning adolescents, I guess, can learn from. Like, that's a real fear.
Yeah.
Putting it all out there, because what if it doesn't work?
Exactly.
And that playing it safe and playing it small is something that is, it's these golden handcuffs, these invisible, you know, well, let's just keep that one analogy. It's like a golden handcuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there is a second, something, I think that was one of the biggest layers to it, where it was, if I don't try, then I can't prove them right. And if I try and I can't do it, then I have to accept that this is going to be my life. And then I think the second layer was like it was almost kind of taking away the safety net. Because up until this point, it was like, somebody else is going to fix this. You know, the doctors know what they're doing, and all the adults, and somebody's going to come and save me, essentially. And I was in that nice childhood, worldview that all problems have answers. We just, you know, somebody has them. And so this was just kind of stepping out, like, just taking a sledgehammer to my own worldview and just stepping out into this very unknown space of like, what happens if somebody doesn't have the answer? And then I don't, and what happens if I walk out here and I can't do it and I can't handle it? What am I going to do then? So I think it was kind of those two moments of like, do I just step out into the void and hope that I can handle whatever comes next?
What did your parents say?
Like I said, they were like, hey, you don't, I mean, I wasn't vocalizing these issues. I was just crying, but they were like, you don't have to do this. Nobody's going to make you. It's fine if you're not ready. I think my parents were always, I think one of the best things that they did for me was that they've always let me make my choices, you know, and they're supportive, but not in the, you know, cheerleader way of like, you're amazing and everything you touch is gold. Just go off and be great. But like, they're very realistic about what is out there and what if, you know, like, this is going to be really hard and laying out exactly what that choice means and then saying, okay, you know, go ahead. Like, I think the best example, going back just for a second to when I was on crutches, we went to Yosemite for like spring break or something. So while there was snow on the ground, and we had had this trip planned for a while, and my parents asked me, you know, do you want to go on this? It's okay if you don't. I said, no, I want to go. So we went, and you know, it's an outdoorsy kind of place, like not ideal for a small child who can't walk. And we were going to go one day. They wanted to go hike Vernal Falls. So it's, you know, you're going up a mountain and it's not a super long hike, but it's kind of steep. And again, up a mountain, and I couldn't walk. And they were like, do you want to go on this? You don't have to. Mom will stay back with you in the lodge or whatever. That's totally fine. And I said, no, I want to go. And so we went and hiked up a mountain. And when I tell that story every once in a while, when it comes up, I feel like the reaction from most people is like, why did you do that? And it always confused me. It's like, what? I don't understand. What do you mean? Why did I do that? Like, why does anyone hike a mountain? Because I wanted to. And just because I had one good leg to do it. I don't think that's a valid reason not to go on the hike.
This is teaching about your relationship with pain as well.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right, good. So we got some gems in here. And then go back to like the last day of school.
Yeah. So I, you know, cry for a long time. My parents say, it's okay. You don't have to do this. And at some point I stopped crying, or mostly stopped crying. And I said, no, I'm doing it. Because I hadn't, honestly, I wasn't sitting there deciding. I had already decided this was me dealing with that decision. So the next morning we get up and I'm ready. And we go drive in the car to school. I just left my crutches at home. I just didn't bring them. And so like, I remember stepping out of the car onto the sidewalk and putting my foot on the ground. And it hurt. But I did it, and then I did it again. And I was not walking. This was like a very, like a hop hobble kind of situation. And I could hop for days at this point. You know, I had a very strong right leg. So I hobbled around school that day, but it was empowering, I think, in a lot of ways. Awful in some ways. but I did it. And that wasn't the end of the crutches, or, I mean, I still use them to get around, but we started weaning off of them. And then I actually did go back to physical therapy and do the kind of the more full progression, relearning how to walk properly and not hobble around and limp and everything.
Do you think that it's pretty clear to you, if that people want to change your life, it starts with a decision?
Yeah. I don't think there's no moment when you're ready for something like that. You know, you can't just push a button and all of a sudden it's like, yeah, okay, I'm ready to go. I think
so. How do you go from that state to playing volleyball again?
Really quickly, actually. So I had started walking, and then honestly, it was probably a couple months later. Like, so this was, it must have been four or five months after that, that I went back to try out for my first team. So I played on my first team when I was 10 years old. And I don't know that I can say the exact progression. Like I went to physical therapy, I was walking again. And in my mind, it was like, I can walk, I can play volleyball. That those two things went together. It didn't seem like more of a progression because I had always assumed that I was going to do that, that I was going to play. And this was just kind of an obstacle in my way that at one point I was physically unable. But as soon as I had both feet on the ground, it was like, hey, that's the next step.
And was there pain at that point?
Oh, yeah. There was never not pain.
So since age 9, and I don't know how old you are now, but 20 some years,
yeah. I'm 28. Would be fair,
like 28. How many days have you been pain free, or how many days? None. Like, what does that picture look like for you?
There is no pain free. It's there's a baseline level of pain that's around that sort of 3 to 4, and that doesn't go away. And then it just goes up from there. So some things make it worse, like walking made it worse, standing on it for long periods of time, anything where I'm on my feet, running, jumping, kind of all the things that we did in volleyball, really.
When you were on the national team, just to make it on the national team means you're probably one of the top, I don't know, 30 in the world. What was the level of pain there? Intermittent, chronic, but would it ebb and flow?
Yeah, it just kind of spikes up from that baseline. So on any given day, if it's a really good day, then it's at that 3 or 4. If it's a really bad day, then it's up at like an 8. If it's like the worst day ever, it's maybe getting higher than an 8.
What does a 6 and 8 feel like? Somewhere in that range?
Yeah, I would say 6 is like this is I'm having to really focus to get through, and 8 is like I'm having to really focus to walk. Like I have to, this is going to be weird, but I have, like, sometimes I have to think about how to walk properly if I'm tired and it hurts a lot, which is crazy because I'm supposedly an elite athlete. But that's the point where it gets to, right? Is like, I remember being in college one time and just looking at a set of stairs and like tearing up. So yeah, on any given day, it could be anywhere in that range. But
when you get out of bed in the morning, what does a 3 or 4 feel like? That's that baseline. Like when you put your feet on the ground, what does that feel like?
Honestly, at this point, it's just kind of there and annoying, you know, because it's been that way for so long that I'm not like, oh, wow, this hurts a lot. It's kind of like, I think it's kind of like when people have a ringing in their ears forever, but, you know, obviously more painful. So I would say, like, I'm trying to think of the right imagery for it. Like a bruise, kind of like a really bad bruise, or like light shin splints is probably the most accurate thing, just because it's in that area. So I would say that my general state is shin splints, and then it goes up from there to like, I feel like I have a knife in my shin, or sometimes it's a little bit blunter where it's like, you know, imagine if somebody took a hammer and just hit you in the shin really hard. But like not that moment, but not that moment when they hit you, but like right after that, when you have like the ache of it.
Oh God.
So that,
how did you get through practice? Like how did you do it?
You know how I did it, like breathing and
yeah.
Focus. Just honestly, it's just intense, an ability to just intensely focus, which come, you know, when I was 3 years old and had to pass 100 balls in a row or whatever it was. But yeah, I think the secret is that pain doesn't require a response. So if I'm in the middle of practice or in the middle of weights or something, and all of a sudden the pain spikes up, I can just take that and notice it and say, wow, this is awful. But I'm busy right now. And I need to go do this other thing. And so I'm going to focus on my breathing. I'm going to focus on counting the reps of these squats. If I'm in practice, I'm going to focus on, you know, the ball and talking to my teammates, whatever it is. So that's, it's not like the pain's not there. It's just I'm holding it in a different space. And like, I'll deal with this later. And I don't think that's something that you can do for an infinite amount of time. Like it takes a lot of energy and it takes a toll. You know, I get out of practice and it's amazing how my body knows it, like the moment that I'm done, and it kind of drops all of the walls and it's just like everything hits. And so, yeah, I get out of practice sometimes and just go back to my apartment and be like, I'm out. I'm in my bed and I can't conceive of doing anything else. Like, it's very difficult for me to think about what am I going to have for dinner, you know? But for that fixed period of time, for that 2 hours or 4 hours or 5 hours that I'm in the gym, it's like, I'm here to do this thing. And the pain isn't allowed to interfere with that.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code Finding Mastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it A-Q-U-A-T-R-U awkwardtrue.com and enter the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout. Again, that's awkwardtrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there.
There's lots of jobs. There's lots of career paths. There's lots of passions. Yeah. You know, like there's
why did
things
I do this?
You can do. Like what?
Why did I choose this one?
Yes. I mean, volleyball is like incredible deep squats on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And jumping as high as you possibly can.
Yeah.
So like why that sport?
I love
of
it.
All the different, if you wanted to be an athlete, why not something else?
Yeah, I don't know that there were a lot. I mean, maybe if like I was a swimmer, that would help. I've loved volleyball forever. I mean, like I said, my mom brought me in the gym when I was a baby, probably. And it's just something I've always known about myself.
And this wasn't to have mom's approval.
No.
That's why I was asking early on, like, what was there anything?
Yeah, know, my parents never pushed me into it, or my brother, but we were around it, right? And I was around other sports too. We played other sports, but it was just the thing that I always knew about myself was that I was going to do this. And I think as I grew up, it was just kind of more and more layers of reasons why I wanted to play. And I mean, I love all being a part of a team and all of that, which you can get in other sports, but this was the one that I always assumed. I mean, like I said, as soon as I started walking, I was like, oh, of course. Even when I wasn't walking, I was playing. You know, we would sit on the ground and set back and forth. So, yeah, it's just always been a part of me.
That's incredible. Okay, what are some takeaways that you have about how to get through difficult things? I think that the easy ones that you just laid up here are observe it, notice it. You don't have to respond to it. Focus on something else, drive your attention somewhere else, mm-hmm. and lock into the most immediate task at hand. Okay, how do you deal with the other part about waking up in the morning and dealing with it again?
Yeah. So
what is that first thought? What are the other processes that you use?
Yeah, I think I think you're right. There's two different sort of tracks. One is how do you deal with the pain in this moment, and the other thing is how do you deal with living with pain, which is a different animal in a lot of ways. And I think that I've gone through a lot of different places with that. We kind of skipped over a little bit of college, which was probably when I had to deal with it the most. I think by the time I got to the national team, like I was pretty well trained. Not that it was easy, but I kind of knew what I was doing. And at that point in my life, it was pretty much only volleyball. I mean, I had friends and did all that, but I didn't have to go out and do anything else after. In college, it was different.
I'm also interested, how did you get to Stanford, one of the top universities in the world?
I don't know. It was amazing because it's one of the top universities. It was one of the top programs. And I was good when I was coming out of high school, but I wasn't like the top of my class. I was probably, top 20 to 25 recruits in my year.
For context, how many championships in volleyball has in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years has Stanford won or been in the finals?
Well, we actually we've been in the finals a lot, in the final four a lot. We're tied for the most championships overall. I think we have 7 tied with Penn State. At the time I came in, we went to our, I think, 3rd final four in a row. We've made every NCAA tournament that's ever been held.
Yeah, I mean, it's a monster of a
program.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
So, and you're not sure how you get in.
Well, I mean, you always have that question, right? Of like a little bit of an imposter syndrome of like, why me out of all of these people? And I even asked my coach that after my senior season. I was like, I just want to understand this. What, why would you choose me? But I think, I wasn't physically dominant as a player. So I didn't stand out as some other players do. And that was the case for when I was in the national team also. You know, I'm 6 feet tall, which is very tall for a normal person and not very tall for elite volleyball players. I'm fairly athletic for a normal person, but the people I played with, they're, freak athletes. They're amazing. So I think really what it was is that I was a good volleyball player and not, and I mean that sense of the whole game. Like I was a very, very unusual player, actually. I went to college and ended up playing, I think, at least 4 positions, which is, I mean, it would be like a football player going to college and being, like special teams the first year, and then the quarterback, and then a wide receiver, and then defensive line. Like, it's just like, that's essentially what I went and did, which is fairly unheard of at that level of our sport now. But so I think that's how I got there as a volleyball player. And then I did well in school. And so I wasn't taken off the list because of grades. So I think that that's helpful. And then I got there, and I think what some people have told me is like the hardest part about Stanford is getting in. So once you're there, you can kind of choose the path that, that works best for you. And I ended up finishing pretty much in my third year and then getting a master's in my fourth year. And obviously playing volleyball throughout. So yeah, but it was a very different experience. I think it's a huge jump physically for anyone going from high school to college. And I knew that it was going to be harder for me, and I don't think I knew how hard it was going to be. And so my first year, I got through season and it was fine. And the off season is really when you just get destroyed physically. When you're in weights all the time and conditioning and all of that. And I remember just getting to a point in the middle of my freshman year and going, I don't know what's going to happen next. Like, I think that there was, like I said, there was this kind of baseline level of pain, and then it'll spike up from there. But at that point, it was just like it had spiked up and then just stayed. So it was like this whole kind of new baseline that was elevated. And then it was spiking up from that new baseline. And so all of a sudden it's like, what if, I call it the pain ladder. So this wasn't a new thing for me. It's like, when I started walking, it hurt more than when I wasn't walking. And so then I adjusted to that. And then I started playing volleyball, and that hurts a little bit more, and I adjust to that. And then I get older and I'm lifting and playing at higher levels, and that hurts more, and I adjust to that. This was just like a big jump up to the next rung of this ladder. And I was looking up at the next step going, if I get to that one, I don't know if I can sustain that. So the choices that I saw in front of me were, hey, I can back off a little bit and it'll hurt less, but I won't be as good as I could have been. I'll never know how good I could have been as a volleyball player. Or I can push through this and I'll be the best volleyball player I can be, but I don't know what's going to happen or if I can deal with that level of pain. And what if I can't? I don't really know where I go with that.
And how would you work with that narrative in your head?
That, what do you mean?
How would you work with that narrative? Like,
I literally sat down and was like, okay, what am I, kind of had a conversation with myself of like, which way do you want to go? I searched for loopholes and how I could figure this out in another way. And I got to the point where I was like, there are no loopholes. Which one is it? And what I decided was that I can't do it halfway. You know, I can't walk into the gym every day and look at my teammates knowing that I'm not giving them everything that I have. I can't get to the end of this season. And we had, you know, my freshman year, we had just lost in the national championship. I was like, I can't get to the end of the season and lose the last match like that. And then look back and say, oh, I could have done more, but I didn't because I was afraid.
And what is the worst thing a coach or a parent or a teammate has said to you?
I don't know. It wasn't about them, though. It wasn't about what they were going to say. I remember thinking this. I was like, they have no right to judge me for either of these choices. Because, like, I don't think anyone has any right to judge me if I don't want to get out of the bed in the morning. Like, this hurts and it's real. And the choices that I make are up to me, but nobody can tell me that I'm not doing enough. Like, I'm already doing more than I'm supposed to be. So
did you ever get second guess, like if it's real or not? Like, oh, she's making it up.
You know, when I was little and first going to the doctors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't enjoy those doctors. but never from my teammates or my coaches, mostly because, I mean, honestly, most of them didn't know about it until after they had known me for a while.
Okay.
And I've played with people who never knew, not in college.
What's the most, Because you wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the most supportive types of things that people would say that did know about it?
One really important thing that somebody told me, one of my teammates, when I was actually going through this process, when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, she was a couple years older than me, and I had finally said something about it, like, hey, I'm kind of struggling. And she was like, kind of offhanded, like not even intending for it to be a deep thing, but she was like, hey, you're not alone. And then kind of went on with the conversation, and it was just like, hey, you should go talk to the strength coach, you know, let them know, whatever. But in my mind, it just kind of like echoed, because it didn't, not that I didn't have a support system or anything, like my parents were amazing, everyone around me was great, but I didn't talk about myself. I was alone so that I had to be the one to deal with it. And so in that moment, her telling me that was like, oh, wow, I do. You're right. And I knew that, but I didn't know it.
What is your thought of what is actually happening in your body?
I don't know. We haven't even gotten to the part where I got undiagnosed, but I think that there's just like signals crossed, and I don't know where or how. But there's just a lot of confusing things about it that don't follow the textbook. I think that's the problem. I think that my body is not the textbook. And none of our bodies are, but mine is especially not, apparently. And so I don't really know how to conceptualize it, because I don't know where the issue is or enough about how brains work to figure out what's actually happening.
Mm, okay.
But the way that they explained it to me that was most helpful, even when I was 9, was like, there's pain signals that are just being misfired constantly. And so I think now that pain has just become the default. And so my body just understands that pain is normal, and I don't know how to convince it that it isn't.
Wow. And what is the hardest part? Is, I don't imagine it's the physical pain, but I don't want to assume that. But what's the hardest part?
It's not the physical pain at all. It's the helplessness, I think, and the lack of control over any of it. So, and I dealt with I. It's come up many times in my life, I think, but I remember my sophomore year in college getting to the point where it had gotten really, really bad. And that's the point when I went back to the doctors. I hadn't gone to the doctors in like 10 years. And I went back, but it was either that year, my junior year, where it kind of came to a head, and I finally went to my coaches and said, hey, I need to take something out. Like the condition, we ended up taking out conditioning and some of like the heavier lifting, but that's not something that I did. Like, I was very adamant that this wouldn't affect my life as much as it possibly could. Actually, that's an important moment. When I couldn't walk, or right when I started walking, I promised myself when I was, 10 years old, I was like, this is going to affect my life as little as possible. And I think externally that has been the case. Obviously, I became a professional athlete, but also there's 100 different ways every day that it affects me. It changes how I put my socks on and how I walk up and down stairs and everything. But I think that I had sort of carved out volleyball as like the one thing that I had roped off as, you can touch everything else about my life, but you can't have this. And so the moment when it started to creep into that, and it was threatening, like, hey, maybe you're not going to do these drills, you're not going to do this part of the conditioning or whatever it was, like, it kind of sent me spiraling a little bit, where all of a sudden, all of those little things that I had always just kind of thrown off as being part of this, it's like every one of them was just kind of another jab, and I felt really out of control.
So when you got that uppercut, And you're so put together, right? Like, it's just the way that you even speak about it and the clarity, like, where's the wild side? Where's the other side where it's like, when you were spiraling, did you get wild? Did you get crazy? You know, or is that a part of you that is not explored? It's just not, I don't know, it doesn't do anything for you. Like, what about that part of you?
Well, I think that it, like, take this moment, for example, I get really out of control. And really out of control is just like in my head.
Wild.
Yeah. I'm not gonna say wild. I don't know about wild, but I got to the point where I was like, I felt like I was in a spiral. Like, I don't know what's happening.
So it's like inner panic is what happens for you.
Yeah, but it's not, but it's also not. So I think the key is that, probably the key to all of this is that I respond much more than I react to things. Mm-hmm. So like in that moment when that started happening, somehow I found the presence of mind to like step out and go, okay, like, let's evaluate this. So even in that moment where it's like, I can feel my thoughts spiraling, like, I don't have to go spiral with it. I can sort of observe the spiral for a second and be like, oh, okay, what do we do next? How do I get out of this?
I can't tell you, like, I just can't tell you how often I think about the science and the practices of the entire field of psychology and probably much of the spiritual traditions. And like, that is it. Mm-hmm. You are not your thoughts.
Yeah.
Get to know them.
Yeah, well,
they're really
think
important,
about...
but you are not your thoughts.
Yeah, but like, consider,
and you are not your body.
Exactly.
Like, it's the crazy part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't know where this, if this was just always how I was. I kind of think it was. But also, you look at sort of the training almost of most of my life. It's like, how would my life work if everything that I felt showed on my face, you know, or I got caught up in every feeling? Like, my default feeling is pain.
you'd be tormented, right?
And exactly.
You know, it's not funny because some people, you look at their faces and
you
can
tell. Yeah.
Right?
So
you can
see
joy and happiness, and you can see torment and angst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm hiding things. It's just like, what am I going to choose to engage with, I guess. So in that moment when I was feeling really out of control, I was like, okay, let's step back and think about this and, like, you know, really game it out. Okay, what don't I have control over? I don't have control over the pain. I don't control how much it hurts or when it hurts worse. I can't make it stop, which there's definitely like emotion tied to that. And there have been a lot of moments throughout my life where it's like that exact feeling takes over. But what I got to was, okay, if those are the things I don't control, what do I control? And what I realized or re-realized in some ways was I can control what the pain does to me. Like, it's gonna affect who I am. It has affected who I am, I'm sure, in many, many ways. But there's always a choice in that. So whether it makes me afraid or stronger, if it makes me a worse volleyball player or a better volleyball player, and all these different things. And so in that moment, it was like, I'm going to control my response to the situation. And that in and of itself kind of puts me back on steady ground.
What is the message or the guiding thought that you would want to have for other people that are listening? Like, if you could send one message, or you could send, a handful of guiding thoughts, what would it be?
Mm-hmm. I think there's two really key thoughts that have always stuck with me and are probably the reason that I got through anything that I went through. One was that, that I learned as I went, was that I was going to be okay. You know, there were moments that were really, really difficult. I mean, I remember like a 2-week at least period when I was in college where every night I'd get back to my dorm and just cry. And not out of like because I was upset, but I was just so overwhelmed by life and just doing all of this. But I think even in those, I think in that moment, it would have been really easy to keep spiraling downwards. And there are a lot of, there's a huge correlation, which I'm sure you know about, between chronic pain and depression. And I somehow avoided that spiral. And I think a lot of it was because I watched myself go into sort of darker moments and then come out of them. And I realized that was always going to be the case, that I can't see it right now, but I'm going to smile again. I'm going to laugh again. I'm going to see my friends and I'm going to play volleyball and things are going to be good. And so I think that was a really, really key insight for me. Like, whether or not I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, it's there and I'm going to make it through. So that was the first thing, like, whatever happens next, I can handle it. And then the second thing, and I don't know if this came from my parents or who it came from, but I think it essentially boils down to gratitude, but it's about perspective. Like, there are 1,000 things every day that are going on in my life, and most of them are wonderful. And if you ask me on my worst day, you know, mid breakdown, what I think, I'm going to tell you that my life is fantastic, because I think I have the choice of what to look at. So, I mean, every day I get to wake up and go out and be who I want to be and create things and meet people and help people and sometimes play volleyball and do all of these amazing things. And I hurt, and that sucks. But it's like, if I can hold the pain in one hand and hold everything else in the other, it's like, I just have to learn how to fix my gaze.
Cool thought. Is there a phrase that guides your life?
There's a few. The first is, that I think about in regards to sort of this situation is like, I want to openly and consciously love life. I think that's when I thought, at some point I turned around and realized where I was. I think kind of probably like just post college of like, wait, I did that. how did that work? And so I had a moment where I was like, how did I do it? How did I get through the pain and get through all of that and enjoy myself? Like, I don't want to act like I was miserable or depressed. Like, I loved college. I loved high school. I've loved all of my life. And I think a lot of it is because there is always going to be pain and there's always going to be love. And it's about choosing, consciously choosing love. And that's why I played volleyball, to answer your earlier question. It's like, is this a thing that hurts me? Yeah. But it's also the thing that I love to do more than anything in the world. And I think in my life, I want to build my life so that I end every day feeling like the love outweighed the pain. And that's part of what volleyball did for me. And it's not just volleyball. It's the people that I love. It's doing other things that I love. It's music. It's books. It's any of those things that you kind of let consume you enough that it really weighs on that scale versus the pain. So I think that's always been a big thing for me, of like, how do I build my life around that? And then the second phrase that I think guides me right now is, leave it better than you found it. And it being everything, like the programs that I've been a part of, you know, at Stanford, at USA, the company that I'm at now, the people that you meet, like, I want them to leave feeling like they were better for having had that interaction. The world, once I leave it, whatever it is, I want anything that I touch to be better than it was before I interacted with it.
If you were to have the chance to sit down with someone who is a master of their craft, what would be the one question that you would ask them?
What I want to know. I want to know, like, what's the thing about what they do that is really, like, is the most difficult and that people won't, that people wouldn't know, you know, like it's not, hey, I'm going in the weight room and I'm doing squats. That's hard. But what's the thing that's most difficult? And what's the thing that, that you love the most that people wouldn't know about your craft?
Is that because you've kept your condition private for so long that you know that there's something inside you that most people don't know? Is that why you're interested in that? Or is there something
I think it's more, I'm really interested in like the things, I think there's so many layers of things. So like when you watch a volleyball game, it's different than when I watch a volleyball game. In the same way that it would be different, you know, you having a conversation with someone and me having a conversation with someone, like we're trained in different ways. Or if we both went to a ballet, like I don't know anything about that, but if I sat next to a ballerina, we would be having a different experience. So it's almost like uncovering those layers. Like I want to know what people see out in the world. I think there's just endless amounts of beauty out there, and we only experience a part of it in the thing that we're really expert in. And so I think there's beauty to be found in whatever craft the person that you're talking to is involved with that I just don't know enough to see.
That's awesome. All of this is incredible. So I'd love if we could hit like some mindset principle questions. If there's a handful of mindset principles, calm, confidence, focus, imagery, routines, goal setting, you know, those types of bucket of basics. Mm-hmm. Do you use them? Arousal regulation being a big one, I would imagine.
I didn't know that I used them until I met you.
Mm-hmm. Let's be really clear on that. Like you and I didn't do like deep work. Like I worked with the team. So that was more psychoeducational in that way.
But that was the first education I'd had on the subject. And so when you taught us about those things in the context of playing volleyball, I remember having a kind of a light bulb moment of like, wait, I know that.
I've
I know
done
that
all
skill.
These.
Yeah. Like I did that when I was 10. That's how I learned.
Oh, that's really cool. So if you were to help a 10-year-old start their path towards some sort of inner command or mastery, would you say, hey, listen, little kid, it's really important that you get your confidence right? Or is it about arousal regulation? Or would you start them off on focus? Would you start them on imagination and imagery? Setting goals? Mm. I kind of doubt that, but...
Yeah, I think with little kids, I would probably start them on confidence because I think self-talk, there's just an epidemic of just terrible self-talk. And that's having worked with a lot of little kids now that I coach some. But if we're talking about what's going to get you to the top level, all of them are obviously crucial. But to me, I would answer focus. And I think it's kind of cheating because I think focus gets you everywhere else. So if you look at all these other things, what disrupts the calm and the confidence and everything, it's not being present, right? It's worrying about the past and the future. What did I just do that was wrong? What was the mistake that I just made? Or what are people gonna think if I don't do this right now? So to me, that focus in the moment gets rid of all of those questions and just allows me to do what I'm doing.
And then what's one way that you would suggest people train it? I mean, there's lots, obviously, but what would be the one that you would say, hey, start this way?
What would be the thing? I think I don't know if this is exactly what you're looking for, but I think especially in sports, it's like a reframing of the competitive mindset. I think to me, a lot of people think that being competitive is being the loudest or the angriest or whatever, having the biggest reaction to what just went wrong. And probably just given my nature, that's never been how I felt about it. I always felt like being competitive is doing the most that you can to win. And that usually doesn't involve a lot of like screaming and all these other things. So it involves, you know, getting on to the next task as quickly as possible. So the way that this is kind of specific to volleyball, but I'm sure it can apply to other places. The way that I framed it, I remember being like probably 15 And this is around the time that blocking becomes a thing because you're tall enough in volleyball. And it's a big momentum shifter, like energy shifter in our sport. So that, I mean, you can imagine those things in other sports too. And like a sack in football, I think would probably be similar. Like a defensive move that just shifts all the momentum. And so I remember watching that happen and then watching the faces of the girls who just got blocked and the body language of them and seeing how it affected them 1 point or 2 points or 3 points later and the rest of their team. And I looked at that and went, I'm not going to do that. I want to figure out how to not do that. And so what I decided was that for any given point, there were really 2 points available. One was in the play that we just had. Okay, I hit a ball and got blocked. We lost the point. The second point is that space right after that. If I let them see that it affected me, if I put my head down, if I walk away, if I get frustrated, I lose the point. But if I keep my head up, shoulders back, I walk back and I want the next ball, then I win that point. And in that moment, it was just about blocking, but it became kind of how I thought about reacting within the game.
Oh, the space between.
It's the space between. It yeah.
is. So, it's so good.
I just think there's this misconception that like the game, especially for us, that it exists like once the whistle blows and then the whistle stops it, and it's a start and stop thing. It's like, no, the game is 3 hours long, plus, you know, including time before and a little bit of time after. So I'm going to be in it that whole time. And so whether or not I just won the point that just happened, I'm going to be beating them at the game that they don't even know we're playing.
I love it. It's so good. I mean, you're just loaded with like really rich insights. And that one, I bet, is like one that people are going to be like, oh, I really like that one. But let alone like all the 15 other things about how to orientate yourself to do difficult things is like,
yeah.
So awesome. Okay. I want to give you some quick hits.
Okay.
Street smart or analytical? Where do you index?
I think they're the same. I think it's just about paying attention.
Slow paced environment or fast paced environment for learning?
For learning, fast paced, and then I want to go back and like get it set in my head on my own in a slower pace.
Rule follower or risk taker?
This one's hard for me because I think that there are some rules that you should follow because, you know, it's like I get in a car and I put my seatbelt on because that's a good rule and it's a stupid risk. But I also was an elite athlete and had no business being one. So I think it's like, I think the way that I think about it is more, what do I want to do? It's what my parents taught me. What do you want to do? Look at what that actually means. And then is that risk something that I'm willing to give? And if so, then once I've committed to that, then I'm 100% in.
Love it. Intellectually competitive or physically competitive? You could be high on both, low on both, middle of the pack.
Intellectually. Like, yeah. I want to beat you because I outsmarted you. I wasn't physical enough to be physically competitive. Yeah,
cool. Are you more self-critical or self-positive?
A positive. I mean, self-honest, but I never tell myself that I'm like awful or I suck or whatever.
I believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I have very, very honest but positive self-talk.
Mm. There's a phrase that's a couple coaches have up the Seattle Seahawks with some players, and they're just the most amazing competitors, like unbelievable competitors. And sometimes we come back and say, man, he's so positive. And some coaches will certainly come back and say, he can't afford to be negative. Like he's physically not that gifted. And somehow he's on our team. Like he's amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You just have to, like, I think I always walked onto a court, or I guess now even like I walk into a room and I never think that I'm the most talented or the smartest person there, but I always think that I can hang.
Love that. Okay. Fast decisions or slow decisions?
Probably slower.
Optimistic or pessimistic?
Optimistic or realistic?
Realistic. Well, you can be a realist in both, you know, like, oh, yeah.
Realistic, optimistic.
Okay. Anxiousness or depression? If you had to choose one, or if you were to, if there was more opportunities to fall into one, which one would you fall into?
I don't know. I hold pretty steady. I think. I feel like I've had many opportunities to fall into depression and I haven't, but I'm very decidedly not anxious. So, like, I don't know.
Awesome. I figured that so much, yeah, for sure. And then do you have a high trust of others or low trust?
Like strangers?
Mm-hmm.
I would say like medium to high. I think I trend towards more towards, I think people are generally decent.
And then yourself?
High trust.
High trust. And obviously introverted more than extroverted. And do you do what you think is right or feel is right?
I try to find where they align, but I would take feel.
Okay. Pressure comes from?
Lack of conviction.
It all comes down to?
It all comes down to love.
Love that. Of course I do. The crossroad was?
I think the two most important were obviously deciding to walk. That was critical. And then that moment in college when I decided that I wasn't gonna go halfway just because I was scared.
Gosh. In some weird way, I hope that all people, you know, have those moments. You know, I'm not wishing chronic pain. I'm not wishing, you know, any kind of condition on people that, you know, that you've had. But it's like those moments where there are a crossroad and you say, you know what? I either stepped through it and I tripped or I didn't step through it and that's the worst thing. Or I stepped through it finally and I figured it out. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that. Yeah, exactly. You don't want to wish anything bad on anyone, but bad things are going to happen. So,
are you familiar with Harold Kushner's work? Why bad things happen to good people?
No.
Yeah, legendary rabbi, and just a great book. You know, it's a quick little read. You might enjoy it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I always just think of Karch, and who was the coach of the national team, who you know well, but he. He just encouraged us to, I don't know, almost like greet adversity as a friend, I think, is how I framed it in my mind. And which is so empowering. Like, if you think about how my day starts, right? Like, I wake up and then I put both feet on the ground. And in that moment, I already did the thing that was not supposed to be possible. And then I'm going to go about my day. Like, what else is going to happen that's going to be harder than that?
What a framework. Oh my God. Okay. Extraordinary, really. Like, really extraordinary. Okay. How do you define or articulate the concept of mastery?
I think it's definitely sort of an infinite process that to me is at the intersection of a deep commitment to learning. And the pure expression of yourself.
Awesome. And that nexus is like a continual loop where sometimes I'm in the more learning phase and sometimes it's easier for whatever reason to have authentic expression, but it's just like this great undulating, orbiting, looping process. I love those two that you picked.
Yeah, because you know that, I mean, we've all seen people who are excellent at what they do technically, but you can't feel it, you know? Like I know volleyball players who are, you know, the top players in the entire world who I watch play and I'm like, oh, they're amazing. But in my mind, I wouldn't think of them as a master, you know, because they aren't in it.
Cool. I love that. All right. Where can we find out what you're doing? Where can people follow along what you're doing? I know you've got a new venture that you're into and
yeah,
maybe you can share some of that, but where can people follow?
Yeah, what do I have? I'm on Twitter, at Cassidy Lichtman.
Spell the whole thing.
CassidyLichtman. I think I'm on Instagram as Cassidy Lichtman 7. I think Facebook's the same. What else do I? Oh, I have a blog. CassidyLichtman.blogspot.com.
Love it. Very yeah. Cool. Yeah. So quickly share with us what you're doing.
Yeah. So I retired probably a year and a half ago from the national team. Went and coached really quick for a season at Stanford and then decided that's not what I was going to do with the rest of my life and went out in the world. So like earlier I said that I always knew I was going to play volleyball. And I think the only other thing I've ever known in my life was that I was at some point going to do something other than play volleyball. And so I just joined a new company called Shift 7, which was co-founded by Megan Smith, who was the chief technology officer of the United States for Barack Obama. And before that, she was in Silicon Valley and was a VP at Google. And so she's really brilliant and started this company that's essentially looking at how do we start to tackle some of the biggest problems of our time. Like the earth and the environment and economic inequality and diversity and inclusion and representation in media. So it's a lot of different things, but the idea behind it is that nobody's going to do it on their own. No one company or billionaire or whatever is going to come and solve these problems. It's about including everyone. So Shift 7 as in 7 billion people in the world and 7 continents and 7 oceans. And if you hit shift and 7 on the keyboard, it's the and sign. So it's this kind of radically collaborative, inclusive idea that if we go out and find all of the people who are already honestly solving these problems, because they are. These solutions are everywhere and innovations are everywhere. But they don't always get scaled because they're not in Silicon Valley or the person isn't the right gender or race or whatever it is. So how do we find those and then connect them to the networks and resources that they need so that we can actually solve some really massive problems that we're facing?
So good. I would expect exactly that. That's so good. Okay. So Cassidy, thank you for your time. Thank you for all that you've taught me and that I've been able to learn from you and all that you're doing in the world. So phenomenal conversation and wishing you all the best.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah. Okay. All the best. Take care.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well,
and keep exploring.